Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. Here we are once again in the beautiful downtown studios of
KHOI. With snow outside the windows.
Spring is definitely teasing us today. We thought we were home free. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, this it's way too early. We were just being hopeful.
This is Iowa. We get by at this station with a lot of help from our friends. We're all mainly volunteers here. This is community radio. Hey, if you don't like what you hear on the radio, come on into this station and make your own darn show. That's how we got here. Although we're in our third year already.
We're in our third year.
Who would have thought? And they teach us a lot of things, and we've learned a lot of things, and this is a fine bunch of people to work with.
They've turned on into engineering, practically.
Well, I can push a couple buttons now. Yes, yes, sir. Anyway, we do get help from a lot of community folk, and this is one of them.
Support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
And we do, too, yes. I do have, despite the snow coming down, or coming down last night, and it was sleet and cold, and there are some things popping up in the greenhouse. I'm sure a lot of really, really optimistic folks also have their little cups of this and that sitting on the windowsills. And I've got some shallots and leeks kind of shouldering their way out of some flats. It's a little early for anything else. My greenhouse does not have any extra heat, so I don't really push it very much. But, oh, I do look forward to getting my fingers a lot dirtier. And the orders and seed catalogs are coming. It just sort of warms the heart. And to stack up all those seeds and think of spring, I got a great big load of potting soil yesterday. Ah, yes. And that was that. Things are coming. Things are coming. Another nice thing about this time of year is that unexpected things happen with your house plants, too. For years, I've been growing a plant called a pregnant onion. Sometimes you call it a weeping onion, too, but it's a pregnant onion. It is not edible, but it is of the allium family. And this time of year, when you're not looking, it sends up this huge stalk about 2 feet long, bends over. It kind of pokes you in the eye, if you would know. Big thing with the big multi-flowered white flowers, very allium oniony looking. And it's just one of those joyful things that happen in the spring. I've given and sold some of these plants to other folks. They reseed themselves by making little teardrops, little onions fall off of the big mother plant on the bottom, underneath the papery skin, and these little teeny tiny bulblets.
So it's kind of self-seeding?
Self-seeding.
Oh, boy.
You can plant these little bulblets, and in about 2 or 3 years, you have something about the size of a pea can go into something about the size of a softball. So, and that's kind of the mother plant. I had a good farmer's market customer come up to me at the food co-op the other day, just pleased as punch. Oh, she said, a flower, my pregnant onion is blooming. She had no idea it was going to do that. And it's one of those spring things. So enjoy what little bits of spring we are having this week. Yes, we are. It'll come. Donna, you were busy this weekend.
I went on a little road trip this weekend to western Wisconsin, La Crosse. We drove up with actually Mary Swander, our poet laureate of Iowa, and Joe Lynch, Lana's husband. And we went to the Moses Conference, and that is Midwestern Organic and Sustainable Educational Service. It is the largest organic farming conference in the world. So it was me and 3,600 other organic farmers. I love the conference. It's always really so many different ideas, so many different topics. Talk about seed catalogs. All the seed companies were there. Lots of, you know, natural soil amendment products that organic farmers use. Lots of seminars. And I think Joe went to one on rabbit farming where you pasture the rabbits. I don't know how they don't get out. I don't know. But Joe went to that. So I was hoping he's going to be growing you some rabbits that I might get a few.
Rabbit.
It was also.
I wonder if you can be a shepherd for rabbits. You know, kind of have a
yeah. I suspect it's sort of like herding cats.
Yeah, little bells around their necks.
Yeah, right.
Well, you never know what you can learn at these conferences.
Yeah, all kinds of things going on. And the wonderful thing about the conference is there are all age groups. Lots of young farmers, lots of middle-aged farmers, and lots of old farmers with many years of experience. I, of course, was really interested in attending the policy. Seminars and stuff like that. And I learned a lot of, that the USDA has this ongoing committee. You know, it seems like Tom Vilsack is trying to talk the organic and conventional farmers into a big truce and peacekeeping measures and how to, but the upshot of it, of course, is, you know, the organic farmers are not the perpetrators here. They've just been farming like this for hundreds of years, right? And along comes this technology that keeps invading and overstepping its boundaries and pollinating in the wrong place. And there's drift and spray and contamination. And, you know, what's a poor organic farmer to do in the overwhelming onslaught of this? So the reports from those committees and the new kinds of modification, genetic modification techniques that are in the pipeline are a little bit, it's horrifying to somebody that doesn't, you know, if one is trying not to eat genetically modified organisms, basically on the basis of that, you know, we haven't really dealt with these kinds of novel plants and animals in the food system. So, you know, I'm one of these people that, as in the precautionary principle, I think we need to test a little more before we unleash large quantities of this, which we have already done. So anyway, I will be talking more about that in another program. It was lots of fun, lots and lots of fun. And we stopped for the night in Maquoketa, where the community of the bankers and the general community are supporting a lot of arts organizations there. And we saw the paintings of Rose Franson, who is sort of an Iowa treasure. She is from Maquoketa, and she does oil paintings, one of which is hanging now on the ISU campus. We'll have to find out what building it's in and go over, because it's the George Washington Carver teaching the young Henry Wallace. I saw a copy of the painting. It looks really, really beautiful. So one of the things we were doing up at Moses was launching an organization that Mary Swander and Fred Kirschman started right here in Ames that is now going to be a national organization called Ag Arts. So it is to encourage rural artists, especially those who are dealing with food systems, and to really communicate about the realities of, you know, farming, food, things like that. So we had a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Sounds like a dandy weekend, and we'll
find
out more.
A big Iowa road trip, yes.
We'll find out more. Today we're going to be considering, like we do normally on this show, things that we eat. We're going to be considering the whole hog today. We have a wonderful guest in our studio, Nick Oady. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me on.
Nick Oady works for Practical Farmers of Iowa. He is the research and media coordinator concentrating on crops and livestock. He said he came into what he's doing now via being a journalism and English major person at the U of I, and then transferred to, or then graduated, and then came for later further studies at ISU in a sustainable agriculture. And here he is working for Practical Farmers, and he's going to talk to us today about how you deal with the whole hog. We're used to getting our meat in these really interesting,
at the grocery store.
At the grocery store, in little foam packages with the plastic over them, and they're labeled, and they're all cut up for us. But it doesn't start out that way, folks. And of all places here in Iowa, we should consider where things come from. And here is a lunchtime disclaimer, folks. I know this is a noon hour for many of you. We come on live on Tuesday here at noon, and we're going to be talking about butchering a hog. So if that sort of thing makes you a little averse to eating your lunch, well, turn the radio down.
Well, get over it. Oops, sorry.
Or sing loudly or something. Listen to the show. You'll probably learn a lot. So here's Donna and Nick
talk about, first of all, I have to say, in my travels, like, for example, when I was in New Zealand, nobody has pork like we have in Iowa. We have the best pork in the world. It's really, really true. So, Nick, tell me how you embarked upon this adventure.
Well, first of all, I think the most important thing is that the story starts with the farmer. And so a friend of ours, a friend of mine, Dusty Farnsworth, is a beginning farmer out, and he farms near Adair, Iowa, in west central Iowa. And he called...
Wait, he must have a name for his farm. Everybody's having these cute names for their farms.
You know, I think his is just Farnsworth Farms.
Okay. All right.
So Dusty called myself and Stephen Galens, who I worked with, and he said, we have a hog for you if you want it. The hog wasn't gaining weight fast enough to make it to market, and so he wondered if we wanted to buy the whole hog. It's a little bit smaller, but than you typically sell at the market. But then we didn't need as much meat, so that worked out good for us. And we wanted to learn how the process worked.
Speaking of a little smaller than normal, how much was this hog?
How big was this little smaller than normal hog? What do you think?
I think about 150 pounds.
Oh, okay.
So not a small animal by any means.
Okay.
So we went out. So we went to the farm, and this was a January day. It was about 10 degrees out.
Oh, that's a little cold for butchering, isn't it? Yeah.
Very cold on the fingers. When you're there, but that
probably
makes
a little wind blowing to make it even more fun, right?
A lot of wind blowing, in fact.
Okay,
but that turned out to be useful for a couple of reasons. It allowed us to chill the hog
very
fast. Quickly. After we killed it, which is something that you wouldn't be able to do, or it'd make a lot more difficult if it was in warmer weather.
So let's start with the nasty part. How did you kill it?
So we killed it by shooting it in the head right between the eyes, a little bit above right between the eyes with a .22 rifle. That's quick.
And then what did you do next?
So,
cook something else quick, right?
Immediately, we stuck the hog in the neck to try to get most of the blood out. While the heart's still pumping and get some of that blood out.
Did you
out.
Hoist it up to get it to drain fast? Or?
And then right after that, we hoisted it up on a skid loader that he had there and got it to drain. And then the next step was gutting the hog and skinning the hog.
What kind of knives did you use?
Sharp ones. So,
yeah.
So I used a hunting knife that I had made sure to get as sharp as I possibly could.
So did you gut it next or gut it and then skin it? Is that what you did?
Skinned it and then gutted it.
Okay. Okay.
I think. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So then the first thing we did was gutting it, and we saved several of the organs. So we saved the heart and liver and kidney. Mm-hmm. Kidneys.
Did you step in here? Did you save the blood that was coming out?
We didn't.
Yeah. Okay.
I'd read a little bit about making blood sausage, and that was going to be another added challenge. We decided not to do that this time, though.
What, you had enough challenges. I mean, this hog has lots of parts.
This was their first hog. So.
Exactly.
Okay. So the organs again were the heart.
The heart, liver, and kidneys.
Kidneys.
That was the first thing we did. We got all the guts out, and then we hung the hog and kind of split it open a little bit so that we could let it cool down a little bit. And we actually went off for a pheasant hunt while we were waiting for that.
Did you get pheasants too?
We missed a couple, but we didn't get any that day. We got some earlier on
out
at Dusty's farm. Yeah.
So and then how did you skinned it?
Yeah. So and So typically what you'd want to do with the hog is you'd want to scald it. Mm-hmm. But you really, to scald a whole hog, you need a bucket of water big enough to fit that hog in. And you also need to be able to control the temperature on that water to get it, I think, somewhere around 150, 160 degrees. So that creates kind of a problem. If you don't have a scald tank already set up, it's a little bit difficult. So we didn't have that for this one, so we just skinned it. And that was something that I did have experience with from skinning a deer in the past.
Is it harder than a deer or about the same?
Yeah, it's a lot harder than skinning a deer because the deer hide comes off pretty readily, whereas a hog, the fat layer sticks to the skin. Mm-hmm. So you need to pull down a little bit, cut the fat away, pull down a little bit, cut the fat away, because you want that fat on there.
I was going to say, were you able to save the fat then, right?
Able to save most of the fat. You know, there's some left on the skin when it comes off. But, I mean, we really made a point of trying to save as much fat as possible because that's the whole reason for the hog, I think.
Right. There were two of you working on this process.
Yeah, actually, it was Dusty and Stefan and I.
Okay, so three.
Yeah,
it's a big animal. I mean, using all those hands is a good idea.
And I think that if you really want to make full use of the hog, it's really a community effort because there are a lot of things that we didn't do, like making the blood sausage, using the intestines for casings for sausages. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that are kind of labor intensive, and so if you have a lot of people helping out, it could be. It'd be a lot more, you could use more of the hog more effectively.
Oh, so speaking of the whole hog, there are lots of parts in there that are useful. And the knowledge on how to use this stuff, well, there's always the internet, even if we've forgotten.
There are actually quite a few, there's a lot of books about it now, some good videos. A lot of people are butchering their own hogs again, which is, it's good that we're not losing this knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's how that's really how I figured it out. I'd cleaned a lot of wild animals before, but the hog's a lot different because there's a lot of things that you can take advantage of more easily than you can on, say, a deer, namely the fat. I mean, it enables you to do a lot of different things. And it is true that even when my dad was growing up on the farm, they didn't do much for hog butchering on farm. You kind of have to go back a generation to my grandma's generation. And really when she was a girl, and that's really the last time, at least in our family, that it was, that those type of things were common on
that's
the farm.
That's about right. I can remember as a child, my uncle in Southeast Missouri would butcher on farm, and I was maybe, oh golly, under 10. Which would put me, that would put us in the late 50s. And they had, we didn't arrive until the hog was already dead. And they had these big, two big scaffolds hanging up with the hog hanging. And everybody was running around furiously making cracklings. And he had his own smokehouse. And, you know, it's a vivid memory for me. And people, you know, I never saw it again after that.
It is obviously a communal animal.
Oh, yeah.
If you do want to use all
every bit of it. So, all right. So, in the 10 degree weather, you skinned it and split it. Then what happened?
So then, after it was cooled down, we broke it down into, I guess, three pieces. First of all, which were the two halves, and then the head. Mm-hmm. And to make it a little easier and to not make Dusty's kitchen too messy, we just put that in my van and hauled it back to Ames to continue.
Oh, so once you skinned it, you took it, or did you skin it in the kitchen?
Nope, it was.
You skinned it outside while it was hanging up on the skid loader, right?
Okay. Yep. And then once we halved it, we put that in the back of my van. We took that back to Ames, and then we continued the process, which was we quartered each side into the primal cuts.
Did you have to like lay it in the bathtub or someplace? How did you keep it all?
We had a table, and so this was a small enough pig that it could fit on kind of a long folding table.
Okay, yeah.
And you needed this in your apartment in Ames.
Yep, sure did.
See, one can do this. Yes, so.
So what else did you do with it?
Well, so...
Now, wait. Were you able to keep the feet?
Was not able to keep the feet.
Well, do you know that Story City Locker is buying a scalder? I just checked last week. It's not installed yet. But the scalder is for cleaning feet and hooves and tails and things like that that we've had to throw away. So pretty soon in our community, we're going to be able to have pig's feet and other wonderful delicacies like that.
Well, I sure wish I could have used the tail and the feet, because I know the tail would be good for making stocks and soups, and the feet, if it was possible to pickle them. I know that my grandma loved pickled pig's feet.
Mm-hmm,
so.
Mm-hmm. Well, by this time next year, Nick, we'll get around to that recipe. I hope somebody still has it, mm-hmm. and we'll be talking about that. So tell me what other things you were able to do.
Well, so first of all, we broke down those two halves into quarters, and we got those cooled off. And it was nice that we were able to use our back porch kind of as a cooler, because it stayed in between 30 and 40 degrees in that cold weather.
Perfect,
so
yeah.
That was great. And we did a lot of standard things with those quarters. We made some roasts, and we cut up the side for smoking to make bacon out of and some ribs.
Oh, okay, good.
And we used the hind quarters to make a couple hams.
Nice. Yeah. Are you aging them, or you just smoke them, or
just cured them and baked them? So they're not maybe necessarily a true ham, but
How'd you cure them?
Did a salt and didn't use sugar in the cure, which I realized would have made it taste a lot more like ham with the sugar in the cure. But it was more of a savory brine, I guess, with
so
peppercorns.
So you brine them then?
Yep.
Basically.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Brine them for how long? At what? In the refrigerator?
In our back porch refrigerator.
Oh, right. Back porch refrigerator. In the walk-in refrigerator.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what did you do? Use a big 5-gallon bucket?
Yep,
put
sure,
the brine
got a food grade bucket and put the brine in there and let it brine for about a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then simmered that ham until it was falling off the bone, and then
stovetop.
Yep, and then finished it in the oven with a glaze.
Ooh, yummy, yummy.
Ooh, we're talking to Nick Odie about how a hog turns into something that we put on the table. It sounds like a wonderful process. We're kind of getting into all the good tasty bits now. You are listening to KHOI. This is 89.1 FM, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
We're back. We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're in the kitchen here with Nick Odie.
We're talking ham.
We're talking about, you've heard the expression, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Well, when life gives you a whole hog, you can make lots of things.
So Nick is talking about breaking down a whole hog, and the ham. Now, the ham is actually a cut. It's the hind leg, and you treated yours by brining it. And what did brining is it? You put it in a wet solution, and brines often, they always have salt. They often have sugar. You didn't put sugar in yours. What else did you put in for the flavors?
So some things like a lot of garlic, black peppercorns.
Fresh garlic.
Yeah. Bay leaves.
Yes.
Coriander seeds.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was about it.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
So, and then you roasted it? No, then you stovetop cooked it.
Yep, simmered
was
up.
It the whole back leg ham cut?
A little... More or less, but not the shank.
Yeah, all right.
Yep, and then so simmered it until it was basically done, and then pulled it out of there and made a glaze and finished it in the oven to get that nice crusty glaze on the outside.
Oh, so the glaze must have had sugar in it.
The glaze did. Yeah, yeah it was a mustard glaze, and molasses maybe, I think.
Okay, yeah. So you had two hams.
Two of them. Yep. So did the same thing with the other one, except for I froze that after simmering it.
Oh, you froze it cooked. Okay.
Yep. So it's ready to just be heated up and finished in the oven.
So, yeah, that's just a lot of meat.
Yeah. So, yeah. Too much ham to have at once without a big group of people to heat it up.
Yeah. And what other cuts did you have?
Well, so the other whole cuts, like I said, a lot of roasts and then also did – with the side made ribs and bacon. It was a smaller hog, so there wasn't much for ribs, but there was a decent amount of bacon. And I borrowed a smoker from a friend of mine, and then put a dry rub with a cure in on that side.
Tell us what the dry rub was.
So the dry rub was just, again, I didn't use sugar. It was just salt and then a cure. Which is a sodium nitrate or a nitrate.
Where'd you get the sodium nitrate? How do you?
This was a standard Morton's Tender Quick, just that you buy at Hy-Vee, just because I didn't have time to, not planning ahead. I didn't have time to get a different kind of cure, such as saltpeter. And you wouldn't necessarily need a cure, but it gives it that kind of characteristic red flavor appearance and flavor. And so that's what I did with that, and then ended up smoking the bacon on that friend of mine's electric smoker, and it turned out pretty salty, and I think that type of cure does that.
Yeah.
But it was good, and it had a nice smoky flavor, and we've been using it since.
So you used the belly, basically?
Yep.
For that, okay.
Yeah.
And then what about the rest of the fat? Did you make any lard?
Yeah, made a little bit of lard.
Did you get leaf lard or just lard?
Got some leaf lard, which comes from the inside of the cavity.
Right, it's the lard it's a special kind of fat that's supposed to be the best for making pastry.
I have heard that term leaf lard, and what's the difference? Leaf lard and regular lard.
I mean, it's a different placement of the fat. Was it visually identifiable?
Oh yeah, it's a much it looks a lot different. It's not as tight. It's not as hard. It's a little bit softer.
I guess that's why it's
called
leaf.
Kind of more in clumps.
Yeah.
Kind of more in clumps, basically. And I had read that was the good stuff for making lard. And all I ended up with from this hog, which is a smaller hog, was about a mason jar full. After I rendered the lard and cooled it off, it fit in about
Right. It's not as – it's the smallest amount of fat.
Right.
And it's the most delicate.
But it's the good stuff.
Yeah.
Let's define – rendering. That's another term you hear. Rendered lard. What does one do to render it?
Well, usually you put it in the oven at what temperature did you use? In a pan.
Yeah, and I can't remember. I used a Dutch oven and a little bit of water in there to prevent it from browning.
So it's heating it, okay.
So and I had read that somewhere, and I put it in the oven at a low heat, and I can't even remember what. But
I've done it at maybe 300 or 250.
That sounds about
and
right.
What I did was just put the fat, and I didn't have leaf lard. I just put the fat in, and I, as it would melt, I would pour it off and then leave the, you know, the piece sitting there and keep pouring it off so it didn't brown as much as it went on.
Okay, so the idea
just, is you melt the fat off.
Okay, you don't just take the fat off of the animal and like put it in the freezer and use it for pie crust. You have to separate it out somehow?
Yeah, you have to kind of melt it out of the tissue.
Out of the basically. Tissue. There we go. Mm-hmm. That's what rendering.
And I think it's possible that what you have left after the lard melts out is a sort of a crackling kind of thing. I think people even eat that part, too.
Oh, I ate it.
Oh, good. Tell me what you did with it.
I just, once it was rendered, there was some of those, like you said, you're kind of
the little bits.
The little bits. They're nice and crispy, and I think I probably just snacked on them after
just
I was
a little
done.
Salt and pepper and down the hatch.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Salt and pepper, and they're delicious, so.
Well, let's get back to some more interesting bits here. Again, we have a disclaimer that we're talking about dealing with a whole hog here.
It's a dead animal.
It's a dead
that's
animal.
What we eat.
And you dealt with a head. How in the world does one deal with a head?
Well,
a head.
I think this is the part that I'm maybe most proud of, and it was the
and
it was
so
the most
should
fun.
Be. It
part.
Is. It is.
Yeah. So the head, we washed it well after we got it back in the kitchen, and then also brined the head for about a week, little less than a week. And
another in the bucket on the back porch. Okay.
Exactly. Yep. And
did you have the ears and everything?
Yep, the whole thing. So, I think the ears. We took the ears off as we skinned it. It was harder to get them.
Oh,
other than that, everything
because they're
else
edible
was on.
Too, and they're quite. Quite yummy, actually.
Yeah, and I'd also heard that cartilage stuff. I think
we'll get
good.
There. By next year, we'll be doing ears. Don't worry.
Yeah, so the skinned whole head, and so we brine that for, like I said, about a week. And in that case, just salt, no seasonings in that brine. And then rinsed it off, put it in a pot, covered it with clean fresh water, some new water. And then simmered that until it was done, until it was kind of falling off the bone, and took that head out and let it cool down. And meanwhile, we have that water. I forgot. I put stock or broth ingredients in while I simmered that head.
So like bay leaves.
Bay leaves, carrots, onions, celery.
Okay.
So making kind of a – basically making a broth or a stock. After I pulled the head out, strained that, and then reduced that.
Strained the stock.
Yeah. Yep. And then reduced that stock down until it was almost gone. So if you can think of a
make
big
stock
pot.
Make it really thick and yummy.
Very thick. And what you're doing is extracting that gelatin from the head. Lots of gelatin in the head and good stuff.
And collagen kinds of things,
Exactly. And so reduce that all the way down, and then it'll coat the back of a spoon when it's that reduced and thick. Meanwhile, pulled a bunch of the head off, or pulled a bunch of the meat off of the head.
Cool the head down and pull the meat off.
Pulled the meat off.
And there's lots of little cavities. Of course, the biggest part is the jowl.
Mm-hmm.
That has a lot of meat. But
And I should say, like you say, the jowl, I took some of the jowl before I cooked it because I wanted to make jowl bacon with it, and I did that.
Oh, wow.
And that was
That must have been good.
Quite delicious.
That is really a big tradition. Huh?
Yeah. And so in pulling all that meat off, there's lots and lots of good meat on the head.
Way more than one would think. Oh,
a
my
lot
goodness.
Of meat.
Question. Thinking of a head, what does one do with the tongue?
Well, that's funny you should ask, because the first thing I did when I pulled the pig out, I noticed that tongue right there, and I'd never tried pig tongue, and I'd had tongues of other animals, and they were delicious, and I grabbed a piece off and ate it, and it was delicious.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful.
Oh, yeah, I assume it'd be good. So that was cooked with the head.
Yep.
Okay. That's
and
lovely.
So actually the tongue is a little bit firmer texture than the rest of the head, and so I used that I used a lot of that for the head cheese.
Head cheese. I've heard that term.
Yeah.
Head cheese. Here we
There's
go.
There's no cheese in head cheese, though.
No cheese at all. So after I had pulled a lot of the meat off of the head, including the tongue. I chopped it up into little pieces and put it into a glass loaf, a Pyrex loaf pan for baking bread, for example. Filled that pretty much all the way up, and then poured the reduced cooking
liquid. The gelatin
liquid.
Stock over yeah. it, yeah.
Poured that over it until the mold was about full, and put it in the fridge and let it cool off.
So you've got your natural gelatin from the stock, and what that does is make all of the little bits stick together. Did you find yours came out a good thick texture?
It did, and in thinking about it a little bit afterwards, I should have weighted it down. I think it would have pressed it together a little bit better and held together better. But when I pulled it out and flipped that loaf pan over and gave it a couple taps on the cutting board, it came out as a whole and was able to kind of slice it pretty well.
Actually, I suspect that for head cheese, weighting is probably not as important as maybe finely dicing your meat so that the gelatin gets more incorporated and holds it all together. Mm. That would be my chefly guess.
Well, I'm excited to give it another shot with that.
I mean, I've done it, and now a lot of the meat itself is so wonderful, and the gelatin and the way you've cooked it down. The next most important thing is, how did you season it?
Well, that was really just the seasoning of the stock. I didn't add any additional seasoning. One thing I did notice is it was very salty, and I think that was a result of the
brining. Right.
But other than that, it had a very, very strong pork flavor.
Oh,
really
yeah.
Super concentrated pork flavor. And so it was amazing. And
well, when I've done head cheese, I didn't do the brining process. Mm-hmm. I actually roasted. I've done it a couple of times. One time I had a split head, which is really funny because you see the whole jawbone and all the teeth and all of that kind of stuff. But I always wet roasted them, you know, like covered. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a steam process, but you do this till it falls off the bone. And then you've got some juices in the pot. And then I also would take, I have some organic gelatin powder, which is actually pig in origin, probably hooves and things like that. And then I made my gelatin. And this is where you can just get really crazy with the flavorings. I think the first one I made, I was living in California, so we had a lot of lemon zest in it. And, head cheese is, I mean, I'm from a German heritage, so they're going to be a little bit vinegary. Did you put any vinegar in yours?
No vinegar. Huh?
Yeah, they can go that direction. Not a lot, but that way you can control the salt in it.
Yep.
You can make them spicy if you want, because really any place, any culture that's using pork, and there are a lot of them, a head cheese will have the flavoring of that culture. You can, at the gelatin stage, you can incorporate fresh herbs and all kinds of seasonings, and it is a delightful way to use a lot of different things.
And does this stuff, once you get the head cheese made?
Did you get just one loaf? Oh, but you'd use the cheeks in something else too.
And there was a significant amount of meat as
there
well.
Is. There
and I had lots of meat left over for doing other things, but it was mainly the broth.
And you can freeze the parts you don't use.
Exactly.
Does the head cheese freeze too? Or do you want to eat that?
It was gone before I had a chance to
That must mean you've been a good product there. You're listening to KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're going to listen to another fine tune here.
Thank you.
We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We are talking about the whole hog today. And radio is a visual medium. I'm sure your mind is just reeling as we're going through these recipes, and you're thinking about how Nick is telling us how he processed a hog and all the wonderful things he did with it. And believe it or not, this was done in an apartment here in Ames. You can do this. People used to know how to deal with all the parts. And we've been talking about how to butcher it into parts and how he made head cheese. And during that little musical break, I just had a thought, well, head, there's the jaw and there's the jowls.
We talked about the tongue.
Yeah, the tongue. Nick, what about the eyeballs?
Well, I tell you what, after I got done cooking the head and pulled it out of there and pulled some of the rest of the meat off, the eyes were still staring at me there.
Yeah, they would be.
They looked kind of interesting, so I pulled one out and cut it in half and looked and saw what was in the middle, and it looked pretty good, and so I tried it, and it didn't have a lot of strong flavor, but it had an interesting kind of gelatinous texture, and, it actually wasn't too bad.
Yeah, well,
good for you. It's an adventure.
It's all parts. It's all parts. I don't know. Somehow I keep thinking, well, it's probably sort of like a large olive. No, it probably isn't like a large olive, but everything is edible. We're all made of the same star stuff. I think Carl Sagan used to say that.
And I think that in using all of these bits, especially, because we talk about this with stock all the time, a lot of the way our current processing system is, a lot of it goes into the waste bucket. They don't use the bones. They don't use the skin. They don't mostly use the feet and the other parts, which have a lot of nutrient value to them. So, I don't know what's in an eyeball, but probably something that, we need in our own systems. But certainly boiling down the bones and getting all of that stock and all of the collagens and the icky bits, it's really, really healthy. If we eat only the muscle of the animal, that's, we're made out of a lot more than muscle ourselves. And I think we need the minerals and the nutrients that we get from the other parts. So I think head cheese is a really good idea.
Good.
And what about the liver?
Well, the liver, we attempted a pate. And so that was the first thing, actually, the day after we butchered the hog. Lauren, who also works at Practical Farmers, came over and helped out with making the pate. And we diced the liver, and then we diced some back fat, and then ground a little bit of meat off of one of the front shoulders, and mixed all that together with a couple eggs. And the recipe called for brandy, but we didn't have brandy, so I used a little bourbon. I thought maybe a little bit of a sweet thing. A little wine, and then some other salt and pepper and seasonings and things like that. And got it to where it was kind of goopy and sticky. And again, put it in loaf pans and then covered it with foil and simmered it in a low oven in a water bath.
Yeah. That's now my recipe for pork liver pate is on the Donna Lana website. We've talked about it before. It's actually really even easier than yours. Mine is you saute quite a lot of bacon and a lot of onions and a bunch of seasonings, and then you put that in the food processor with the raw liver, blend it all in a puree, strain it through the strainer, and then cook it in a water bath. So you don't have to chop so much.
Yeah.
And it's, you can play around with the seasonings, but I think I've got a pretty good thing going. Seems to be popular in town, but I really like using pork liver. Traditionally, people either like liver or they don't. But some people will accept chicken livers more reasonable because they're kind of creamy and milder. But we've got a lot of pork liver. I've used the same recipe with beef livers, too. I think it's important. With liver, I'm kind of fussy about what the pig ate and where it came from because a lot goes on in the liver. But this sounds like you properly use the liver.
And I'm not a big fan of liver, and I've tried livers from probably most animals that you could think of. Pretty avid hunter, and so I've saved livers from a lot of animals, and I'm not a big fan. But in this case, we had a lot of liver, and so we thought we'd try to put it to use. And I think it's pretty good on a sandwich with lots of onions and mustard.
I would say it's especially with pork liver. It's kind of my favorite way to use it is with a pate.
So.
Yeah, what a wonderful adventure! So you've got, you certainly haven't. Have you eaten all your this hog yet, or you've got stuff in the freezer yet?
Got a lot of stuff in the freezer, a lot of roasts. Been sharing with a lot of friends, and so it's been. I still have plenty of meat, and I got a freezer full of meat left over from the hunting season. So got a lot of meat to work through until next fall.
There you go.
Goody. What else did you hunt?
Pretty much anything you can in Iowa. So deer,
pheasants,
ducks,
deer.
Pheasants,
oh,
turkeys,
ducks too.
Rabbits, squirrels.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
Squirrels?
Yep.
Oh, goody.
Yeah.
Do you have a squirrel recipe you want to give us?
You know, the way I do it is the way that my dad does it, and you just basically skin the squirrel and quarter it, roll it in flour, brown it, and then for a young squirrel, that's enough. You can pan fry a young squirrel. For an older squirrel, you'd want to bake in the oven, maybe at 350 for an hour or so with a little bit of liquid.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit like cooking a rabbit, huh?
We cook the rabbit the exact same way as mm-hmm, we cook mm-hmm. a squirrel.
I haven't eaten squirrel. What's it taste like?
You know, really,
is it stronger than rabbit?
It's different. I wouldn't say it's stronger than rabbit. I'd say it's somewhere in between rabbit and pork, which makes sense because it's a rodent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
There you go.
Similar skin.
I got an adventure looking forward to. See? Sometime you're going to have to let me taste your squirrel.
It actually tastes a lot like guinea pig, which is commonly eaten in Ecuador and Peru.
I suppose. It's amazing. Life eats life. That's kind of how it works. And we're talking about eating the whole hog today and knowing what to do with all of this stuff. Donna mentioned her pate recipe, which is on the Donna Lana Kitchen page of the KHOI website. You can find that at khoifm.org. And you can go there and you pull down the little icony thing that goes that says talk, find Donna Lana Kitchen, and we've got a recipe page there. We also have all our old past shows there, so if you can't get enough of us, you can find more there. So Donna does have a pate recipe. That's good. So besides spending your last month dealing with a hog, Nick, tell us what's going on at PFI.
Yeah, so
Practical Farmers of Iowa. It's spring. Things are hopping. What's going on?
So in the evening, I was butchering hogs, and during the day, like you say, working for Practical Farmers of Iowa. And right now, we're in the process of working with our members to set up on-farm research trials. And so there's a lot of cool things that our farmers are working on this year. And I want to talk just a little bit about a couple of the trials that we're doing. So in the field crops area, a lot of this is focused on cover crops and small grains research. And so we have
That is great.
Yeah. And basically there's a lot of interest in small grains to enable better use of cover crops is one of the main reasons people are interested
in
small grains.
Oats, rye, what?
Yeah, so small grains in Iowa, historically, that has meant oats. And more recently, a lot of people have been growing rye because it's used as a cover crop. And so they're growing rye to use as cover crop seed on the rest of their farm. But one of the main reasons that they like to grow small grains is that small grains are harvested in July, and so you can plant a cover crop in early August, and you can get lots of time for that cover crop to grow, whereas if you're only growing corn and soybeans, you really have a limited window for cover crop growth. And so there are several farmers are
working on researching those. So these are cover crops that they can actually have market value with?
Well, a lot of times the market value, especially for livestock farmers, and that's another area of research that some of our members are doing, is working on how to optimize their farming system to be able to graze cover crops. And so those multi-species diverse mixes that are planted in early August, a lot of times they have enough time to grow a lot by the end of the fall. And farmers can get significant grazing value out of that. They put a lot of
growth
on.
You know, Moses, there were some people who were talking about actually, unless the snow cover is really, really, really deep, they can graze almost all the way through the winter.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really great. It's a way that they can use land that would basically get a little extra use out of the land while providing benefits to that land by adding more manure and adding root growth and biomass.
Right, and providing feed for livestock that you don't have to buy off farm.
Exactly, and that's one way that cover crops and a small grains crop can be economically viable for some of these farmers. And so that's a lot of the focus on the field crops and livestock area. But there's a lot of cool things going on for fruit and vegetable producers as well. Some variety trials on broccoli and tomatoes that some of our producers will be evaluating, and that's pretty exciting because, like a lot of these lesser grown plants, there's less evaluation of different varieties to be able to have an independent.
So broccoli varieties.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So we'll see some of that.
And we love tomato varieties.
Exactly. And then some research on pollinators and how to attract pollinators to farms. And so that's going to be really neat. Some
you
really
know, they talked, there was a wonderful, young man from the Xerxes Society, which is all about pollinator preservation, and he talked a lot about hedgerows, which we hardly have at all in this country anymore, but all over the rest of the world, like Europe and New Zealand, are full. It's like living fences, mm-hmm. and how important those are for windbreaks. They were also talking about how you can actually use hedgerows to protect from GMO drift, even, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. But that also provides mm-hmm. a lot of habitat.
Yeah. For more information about PFI, Practical Farmers, Nick, How can we get in contact with you? How can we get in contact with Practical Farmers of Iowa?
You know, the best way is to visit our website, practicalfarmers.org, and you can find contact info and really any of the information that you need to learn more about our organization.
Good. Thank you for being with us today, Nick. We've learned a lot about the whole hog and other things, too. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
You can listen more by going to khoifm.org. We're live at noon, but also repeated 7 o'clock on Tuesdays. And if you go to the website, you can stream, you can download.
Listen any old time.
Any old time. We are available for you. This is community radio. Also, we'd like to hear from you. What's going on outside your kitchen window? And what's on your plate? You can.
Yeah, and if you've been hunting anything.
Yeah. What's a good recipe? Send us some info here. khoiradio@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. We had music today by Sue Sternberg and Sam Bartlett. Some good banjo and fiddle tunes. These are fine dance musicians. We'll go out with something called the Down East Medley. Lots of good stuff. So tap your toes out there. Think of bacon. Think of all good things. Eat high.
And cheese.
Eat high off the hog. And all the other parts, too. I think that's good. We've had fine engineering today, as usual, by Rick Morrison. So, eat good food and enjoy life.